This is the No Dogma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Steve Elliott, the CEO of Agile Craft. Steve, thank you very much for taking time out of your evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian.
To start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm the founder and CEO of Agile Craft, as you mentioned, and we focus on helping companies scale agile. And what that means is we're helping large enterprises connect what's happening in the business in real time to what's happening on the technology side, and helping the technologists in real time understand why we're doing something, why it's strategic, why it matters, and then have the status of what's happening down at the technical levels go back up so that product management and portfolio managers and folks of that ilk can make better decisions, place better bets. So it's really about driving agility, which has been a thing in the development community for quite some time, taking those principles and connecting it up to the business so that we're driving an agile business. So that's a high level of what we do at Agile Craft.
Are you guys based in the US? Do you go to people's offices, or is it a remote service?
Yeah, so we're a software platform, software as a service. We purely provide the software to do this.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I heard consultancy of some sort. I misunderstood. I apologize.
No problem. No, but we do provide the software platform, and we integrate with products like Jira and Rally version 1, many of those types of products, Rational, TFS. And we're based all over the world now. So we're in Australia, we're in UK, we're in Ukraine, and all over the US. Primarily based in US here out of Austin, Texas.
But tonight we're not going to talk about your company as such, but we're going to talk about a more broad issue of software architecture, and in particular, when someone should consider re-architecting. And you have some experience in that, Steve.
I do, absolutely.
So to start off, a lot of people often want to re-architect. Some people want to do it just because they don't like the existing software, they don't like the language. But in your opinion, when is the right time to consider re-architecting?
Yeah, so this is a to me, I've been CTO of several software companies, and to me this is one of the hardest decisions out there. So when to redo your user experience and when to redo your platform are two of the most difficult decisions that I've personally encountered, because of the magnitude of the change and the risk involved, and the opportunity cost of doing these things. So for me on the platform side, you know, when it really has to come back down to value delivery for me. So there's a lot of symptoms and things that start to tell you, you know, when should we start looking at it? First one would probably be we watch very carefully and always have the usage patterns of the product. And if you start to see people using your product less, for one, from a pure adoption perspective, that's bad. Also see people as they get the product, new customers getting the product, if they don't fully utilize the product across the platform. So, for example, they buy it and they have a very narrow use case, and those use cases are getting more and more narrow. To me, that can be a symptom of a platform that has gotten bloated, a platform where we have architecture that it's not really coming to the surface necessarily. But that's one of the key symptoms. And so, then you're kind of, you know, in other words, if the exploration of your product becomes stale. Obviously, if you're starting to see churn and problems with your customer sat, that's the first thing on the data is to look for, is just what's happening with the usability, with the customer experience. If those are trending down, I usually look to the platform as one of the things that could be the source. And then another thing that I would quickly move towards is just the UI pattern. So If the platform has gotten some age on it and the market is quickly moving towards more modern patterns, so I don't know, what's a simple example? So for example, websites. You know, I remember we launched a website that had Parallax on it before that was on every single website in the world, and that we thought we were very cutting edge. And then now, if you look out there, every page has it. So the same with infinite scroll, the same with single page applications being architected. So that the user doesn't launch new windows and tabs, all of those kind of patterns. I typically look at those as well and see how we stack up with a modern application and a modern architecture. The duct tape syndrome is another one that I talk about. So if we're constantly patching the product over time, you know, if we're patching things here, patching things there, over time, what you end up with is, it's kind of like in code, when you have loose code and you don't have good object-oriented code, you end up with kind of the spaghetti of stuff that gets really hard to maintain. The same thing happens to architectures. And so if we're constantly fixing something over there, and it's almost like pulling a string on a sweater, and then something starts to unravel over here, that's one of the symptoms I look for. If that's happening more and more, and if the paradigm between, you know, being reactive and proactive, if we're becoming too reactive on how we're dealing with architecture changes, that's probably a sign that we may need to look for re-architecting. These days, you know, to me, one of the first things I also look at on a platform, we've got to have mobile enabled products. It's just table stakes at this point. The whole UI piece and having a modern architecture under your UI also becomes table stakes as well. It kind of used to be, you know, if you have a nice UI, if you have a mobile enabled product, then those are good things. Those are nice to haves. They are no longer, in my opinion, nice to haves. They are complete table stakes for the market. So if we don't have everything mobile enabled, if our pages aren't responsive, if our platform is not responsive, look at that as a major signal that we may need to re-architect. Obviously, the customers and your own people are two things to look at. So on the people side, you know, as you and I have talked about before, the technical folks all want to work on the new tech, including myself, right? I want to work on new technology. I want to work on exciting things. And so there's always going to be this pull from your people who want to work on the latest and greatest technology. And I think that's great. I think that's kind of what makes technology professionals really great to work with, is they want to learn new stuff all the time. But what I look for is the talent. Is it affecting our talent, our ability to attract top talent to the company? If you let your tech go too long to where your platform is too aged, it can affect your ability to get the best talent into the company. So I wouldn't say that's the only reason to go to a new platform, but it's definitely a factor. And it's the same thing with your customers. Customers to me used to have a bigger say in our platform. You know, the decisions we made on the OS, the decisions we made with the hardware, all of those things mattered more because we would take our software into their environment. And so they were very concerned, you know, is it Java, is it Microsoft? They had standards and they wanted a certain stack. One of the things that SaaS has done, in my opinion, is made that less important. So customers are less concerned about what stack or what code you're using. You know, they want it to be secure. They want it to be highly available. But if it's in the cloud, they're not as concerned about it. But still a factor. And then probably the last one is just, this one's a little trickier, but it's just the market opportunity side from a platform perspective. So if you can see, there's been things with Angular 1 versus Angular 2 and things like that, where if you happen to be on a technology that you can see is no longer going to be supported or going to not be developed to a point that you need it to be to drive your viability in the future, then you gotta keep the pulse of that and make those moves. So when you look across, you know, the data of how people are using the product, you know, how many products you have on different platforms, things like the what's happening with UI patterns, the industry, duct tape. I'm trying to remember all the ones I just walked you through. The customers, your users, the market opportunity. Those are all kind of like different indicators I would look at across my company. And if a few of those start to go orange or red, then you kind of, in my opinion, you kind of start to think, well, maybe we need to re-architect this platform.
How do you get from, let's say, the maybe to a decision? You've listed probably 10 different things. And there are pros and cons to each. You know, there's customers, there's staff retention, there's going to be cost, there's going to be, you know, competing concerns of driving a product forward versus fixing it up. What's your approach to boiling it down to a decision?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. So that one's a definitely kind of a pro-con type of activity. And it really does vary, because if I'm on a platform where I'm making a major leap from an old tech to a new tech, and my developers know one language and they don't know the new language, you know, there's all kinds of factors that come into it. So it's one of those, you know, multi-factor type decisions where some of it's going to be softer. So on the risk side and trying to figure out how much risk is involved, you know, we always estimation's a little bit of a black art in architecture and in new UI launches. It's very much a black art. They're always really, really hard to completely nail down. And especially, when you're trying to take an agile approach to it. So, so one of the things I've been working on in the last couple of platform re-architectures that I've done is trying to take a more agile incremental approach to it. And that's something I'm excited about. It takes longer, but I believe that it helps reduce the risk. But as far as deciding, right, you've got all those different kind of indicators. And then once I have enough indicators going off, start to do a cost benefit analysis. And I'm looking for value delivery, right? Can we deliver more value, better value, faster value? Can we deliver more extensibility? Can we enable more of the market if we do this architecture change? First question there is, can we increase our opportunity? The second one is, if we take 6 months, 9 months, however long this is going to take to build it, what's our opportunity cost of the other stuff we would be doing in the market? And then all the other factors just about around, you know, we've got to have a scalable platform. We've got to stay up to date to a degree. So it really is a little bit of art and science to make that call. And I think it's one of the hardest decisions that you know, heads of software, heads of CIOs, CTOs, those types of folks have to make, is when do you make that decision to pull over? And I usually try to bring as much data to the party as humanly possible.
Who else should be involved, aside from the engineers, the heads of engineering, and the CTOs?
Yeah, to me, that is a corporate-wide decision. Because, and if you're a software company, you know, obviously it's everybody in the company needs to be involved. But even if it's an IT group that's thinking of re-architecting a platform, you've got to bring the business in, because there is the opportunity cost, and we want to get them bought in on what we're doing and what the benefit of this new architecture is going to be. You know, and it's one of those things where you kind of need everybody to, they don't all have to agree with the decision, but they all have to understand why we're doing it and have the pros, cons, and then someone makes the call. But to me, it's a pretty broad decision. So I know the person making the call, there's probably comes down to a couple key people that make the call, but to me, you need the entire organization around, you know, all of your customer enablement, your customer success, because it affects them. You've got to bring in your service folks, because it affects how they service the product and where it's going and how they message sales, for how they message, how they sell. So it ends up touching finance. It ends up touching pretty much the whole company. So again, with these types of changes, to me, it's definitely not just a technical decision. It's a company-wide decision led by the technologists who are explaining to them why they got to make this move now.
On that why, so you, let's say you're the person responsible from a technical perspective. What is your approach to convincing business that this needs to happen?
Yeah, so it's not exact. I wouldn't say it's exactly like lining up a P&L of both approaches, but it's pretty close. So lining up a profit loss, and maybe profit loss might be a little strong, but lining up financially, you know, what's it cost to go this path? What's it cost to go this path? You know, if this happens, so if we don't go to this new architecture and our cloud can't scale to our customer need, how disastrous could that be to our brand, to our customers? So it's a tricky thing because some of what you're trying to avoid here is pretty big impact. And so, you know, how would you value that? So if you're going to get your cloud to a point where it wouldn't really scale without, you know, kind of an emergency situation that affected your entire base, you know, what is that? What would you pay to avoid that? Well, okay, I would pay a whole lot of money to avoid that. And I try to use factors like that to sell the architecture redesign, because that's kind of what you're talking about. Changing your architecture, for the most part, your users don't care. You can sell them some things if you get more extensibility, but the users just don't care. But when it comes down to business viability and being able to have a future and be able to scale with your customers, it matters a lot. And so it's kind of like, well, if we don't do this, we're going to build these features and we're going to add this new module to the product and we think it'll generate that much revenue. But if we don't re-architect the platform right now, you know, there's a 50% chance that we could hit our head on this scaling issue that could affect the whole company on that product. And so it really is a tricky conversation, but I always try to take it back to numbers, especially if we're having a decision like that that's going to have emotion in it as well. It usually tends to be an emotional conversation with the technologists as well, because, you know, technologists want to, they're proud of their work. They want to be on a platform that they feel good about and that they feel good about supporting. You know, and at the end of the day, no one wants to go home and tell their friends they're working on an old, out-of-date platform. So it does become emotional for the technologists a lot of times as well.
Given that something like this often takes years, and I've seen companies doing things like this where they project 3, maybe even 5-year time frames, how do you go about measuring success or failure and then adjusting as you proceed?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I've shifted my thinking on it. I've always been kind of a big bang approach to things like UX and architecture. You know, let's put everything else aside for a bit and let's get this done. You know, rip the Band-Aid off, right? Make the cut, get the change, and move quickly. And I kind of the way my thinking has evolved, and this might be kind of right, wrong, or indifferent to some of you out there, but my view is on UX, on new user experience redesigns, where it's the front end that's being affected, I still very much take that view. We don't want to have two experiences, two sets of enablement for very long at all, if at all. And so when a company is coming up on a new front end design, I feel that my view is that you need to do those as fast as possible, put everything else aside, you know, ramp up resources, do whatever you have to do to bring that project at least within a year, if at all possible. Easier said than done, but those are so impactful to the user. They feel it, they know it, and it needs to happen quickly. You can't drag that out over years, in my opinion.
Is that because you don't want to present an old UI and a new UI side by side, or in different places? Maybe your login is old and your account management's new. Is that what you're trying to avoid?
Exactly. So for the experience to be, you know, you only get that one chance for that impression with the experience. And if you drip it out, you know, over time, I believe that really takes away from the value. And even if 3 years later, they finally get the whole experience, we've burned up a lot of that goodwill by just kind of having them trying to switch their orientation between the old and the new, right? Creates all kinds of issues on training, documentation, just flow of the application. It doesn't feel intuitive. So to me, that's a change that needs to happen quick. But on the rest of the platform, what I've kind of moved towards is trying to do those incrementally. I think Agile gave us a lot with continuous deployment and the way the build systems are so advanced these days, where we can easily move back and forth between bases and branches. We can easily build testing on multiple bits of code. And so all of that used to be, you know, quite a bit more difficult 10, 15 years ago is easier now. And so the approach I've been taking on with new re-architecting a platform is to try to do that incrementally and slowly. So for example, one of the ideas that I really like and I'm enamored with, and I would consider doing this in any company going forward, is to try to do the architecture. If we decide, you know, redoing our architecture is the right move. For example, take the Friday of every week, and for that Friday, everybody in development moves over to the new architecture, and we work on it for one day a week. And we adjust our velocity for the rest of the teams who are doing the ongoing maintenance of the business and the feature development for the existing business. We just lower their velocity by a fifth, basically. And we have that one day a week where we're really focused on the new architecture. My experience has been, A, we get through the architecture faster than people would think. And B, because it's behind the scenes, as long as we select the components the right way, and we can swap out components as we're redoing them, the architecture, and I'm talking at the database layer, the business layer, APIs, things of that nature. We can swap things out and test them. The customer experience doesn't really change for the most part, and we're getting those new parts of architecture in. And then you look up, you know, a year and a half later, and all of a sudden you've got most of that new architecture under the hood that you're looking for. And the other real benefit to that is, my experience is also that with new architecture, everybody wants to play. Everybody wants to be a part of it. And so with that kind of a scheme, using some of the Agile principles and some of the new DevOps capabilities, it's a little easier for everybody to play and for us to take, you know, like I said, a day a week or a week a month and focus on the new architecture, where we're kind of feeding everyone's desire to learn something new but we're not really putting the existing business in jeopardy other than lowering our velocity just a little bit. And if we do it right and we test it well, we're not going to really affect their experience either while we're doing it.
So let's say you've gotten all those plans in place. You're going to have your one day a week. You've got your business sign off. How would you suggest people start a whole re-architecture? Is there a sort of a kickoff? Is it a start with a bang, start with a whimper? I know you're suggesting one day a week, but there still has to be some sort of ramp up.
Yeah, that part's still a little trickier. That's a great question, by the way. So what we've tried to do in the past is to use that time we're carving off initially for the design. So we're doing basically not a full design sprint, but we're doing the same thing you would do in a design sprint, where the initial time we're taking is really about laying out the plans, laying out how this architecture is going to end up looking once we're done with it, doing POCs on different technologies. You know, so if we're trying to figure out, you know, what, you know, if we really want to do a little bit of a POC on React versus Angular and how they fit in and things like that, doing the POCs is part of that as well, and try to get a lot of the unknowns kind of hammered out for the first, you know, however long it takes. But for the first, let's say, several months, we're doing a lot of POC work, a lot of design work. We're laying out the overall design. And one good thing about it is it slows it down a little bit so that we can think about it. We can do a little bit more market research, talk to more people about the direction we're going. I think we kind of end up taking the design, because that is the trickiest part. It's like, okay, we've got approval. Let's go forward. It can feel like a little while before you start making real coding progress. So laying down code and starting to build things may take a little bit of time until we make some of those decisions about which platforms we're going to use, you know, which technologies we're going to bring to bear, third-party components, all of that. But once we make a decision, if we could start with, you know, the data layer, the business layer, wherever we're starting, we should be able to start to make progress, get it working. I'm a huge believer, and it's probably obvious from my background, but a huge believer in Agile. So get a working slice of the architecture with the new bits, get it working, test it, put it through performance testing, put it through scalability, testing, put it through all the different scenarios we want to do to see if this is really the architecture for scale for us. And then once we get that working slice, then start to go out from there. But don't blow out the technology, you know, far and wide until we've got a full working slice. Does that make sense?
Yep, absolutely. I was talking with a person I know who's a head of engineering at a large-ish company, and she was telling me that they're going to tackle a re-architecture, but they're starting with the hardest problem they have. And we were just chatting at a meetup or something like that, and I was saying, maybe you should think tackling something easy first, because you're going to be moving teams around, you're going to be introducing new technology, new techniques, new third-party tools, some cloud stuff. Do you really want to tackle the hardest thing? They did. I don't know how it's gone yet, but would you advocate for, with this regard to your vertical slides, would you advocate for something easy, middle, hard? What's your approach?
Yeah, for me, if we're trying to pick the, you know, if we're trying to be certain initially that we have the right tech for the future, I would want to pick something pretty meaty, pretty hard, that's going to really task the architecture that we've chosen and really test our choice early. Much rather find that out early rather than later. To the question of momentum, you have to be a little careful with that. So if we give a really hard problem and we just fail over and over initially on that hard problem, it might give our whole initiative a little bit of a momentum problem. So maybe pick an easy one and the hard one. But for me, I'm always trying to flush out the risk early. So I would probably, I personally would try to pick off one of the main reasons we're re-architecting in the architecture, right? So if there's something in there that's causing us issues with scalability or causing us issues with extensibility, I would try to pick one of those and really show some success. And if we can solve one of the hard problems earlier, the upside is huge, because then we'll get the rest of the company and everybody else on board for this architecture product that we already kind of verbally sold them on.
So one One point I would use to challenge that was something I've done in the past. A company moving to a service-oriented architecture, we tackled easier services first because we knew we were going to go through multiple failures of, oh, we'll do the service one way, and then at least if it was small, when we do the second service, we know that we haven't got a whole lot of debt so far. And what we found was it took us about four or five services to hit our stride and figure out that we should use it this way, we should use that with this package, we should use this technique. So then at the end of those five services, four of them, the fourth was okay, the third wasn't as good, the second was even worse, and the first wasn't great at all. But it meant that we had relatively small amount of things to go back and fix. But I understand your point that if you've got something like massive performance problems or some really deep issue, tackling that first can make sense.
Yeah, the thing I struggle with the most on these, yeah, it's a good point. The thing that I struggle with on these re-architectures is picking the right tech and the right platform and the right, you know, because I feel like once we've made those decisions and we've got the right decision, you know, how to spread that across the platform becomes easier. But until that certainty is there that we've got the right technology assumptions and the right pieces selected, that's where I'm still very nervous until we get to that point. And a lot of the risk is behind me. I feel like, okay, we've got the platform for the future. Now it's just work. Now we just got to figure out how to take what we do and get it to that platform, which starts to feel a lot more comfortable. It's a good point, right? Because you also don't want to, if you start with the hardest thing, you may get 2 months in and feel like you've made no progress. So there is a little bit of that as well.
Once you, let's say you went either approach and you're happy with your technology, you're happy with your slice, or you're happy with your iterations, and now you know what you're doing. How do you go about picking the things to work on and the order you should do them in?
Yeah, for me, I would go back to that initial assessment of why we decided to do this in the first place. So if I'm going back to the user data and the product about where they're going and where they're not going, you know, where they go is very important because the parts of the product they're using the most heavily are the ones I want to make great and make scalable first. I would go back to that, to the team feedback, and, you know, the team knows where a lot of the bad, you know, where the bodies are buried in terms of bad code and bad architecture. So I always take that into account, and then what the customers are saying. And then maybe I would do a little bit of an analysis and go back and look at the duct tape we've been doing for the last couple of years, you know, where we've been, you know, patching up the product and kind of trying to stop the bleeding, but probably doing as much damage as good in the process. And see where those changes are concentrated. And then I would figure out where to focus. So, you know, kind of the way I would view it is, if let's say I've time boxed this and I've only got 6 months to make the maximum impact, that's where I would start and see how much of this pain I could remove in 6 months, knowing that I'm going to do the whole product, you know, eventually. But I would try to get myself to a point where, if it was scalability or extensibility or security, whichever issues I was trying to tackle first, that kind of brought on this whole re-architecture in the first place, that's where I'd focus first.
And that's really good too, because then you have your ability to measure whether you're succeeding or failing and adjust as you need. Another question for you then is, how do you keep the lights on? You've got an existing app, it's your cash cow. Without it, you don't make money to pay for the new architecture, but maybe it needs a lot of maintenance, a lot of manual intervention. How do you keep a re-architecture project going and a legacy application going?
Yeah, that's used to be one of the hardest parts of this whole thing is, you know, because once you start it, you know, everybody wants to work on the architecture. And so nobody wants to work on the, you know, fixing defects or adding new enhancements to the old platform. So that's kind of where the deal with the team comes in. And I try to draw like some real boundaries. And, you know, I was using the Friday example. Maybe it's Thursday, Friday. Maybe you have a bigger mandate for this and it's Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And we're just going to use Monday, Tuesday for existing products. But whatever it is, what I've been trying to do with the teams to make sure, A, everybody feels like they're a part of this because everybody wants it for career growth. They want it for their experience levels so they can stay cutting edge. I would try to cut a deal where, look, everybody, nobody's special. So everybody works on the existing product at the same time, and everybody works on the architecture at the same time. It's not perfect, but it solves a lot of the problems that come with, you know, kind of the push pull of getting the new product out and the old. And you're usually able to sell it to everybody involved. The business gets it, so they're not cut off. Their velocity of new enhancements for the product, or you know, patches and bug fixes for the product, may slow a bit, but they've got this big upside. And then it's just up to the team to keep to the agreement that they're not going to neglect the existing products for the you know, the days or the weeks or however you set it up. And then I think that works pretty well. I'm really enamored with that approach at this point.
Have you come across a scenario at all where some people just don't want to work on the new technology? Because I have. There was a company I worked in, and I wanted to introduce MVC and Web API, and I had a lot of arguments about why it was better than web forms, and it kind of came down to, okay, Dave, please continue doing web forms, and I'll do this. Have you hit those kind of issues at all?
I have not. I have not hit that much. I tend to work in fast-growing companies and startups, so I hit it less maybe than if I was in a – I could see where if I was in a larger enterprise, and kind of thinking back in my career, there are people who really, you know, master their language, right? So I've worked with people who, you know, for example, they were masters of SQL Server Enterprise and didn't want anything to do with anything that wasn't SQL Server Enterprise. And if we were moving off that, they would probably resist it to some degree. So, that's an interesting problem. I mean, I guess I would try to figure out a way to accommodate that to a degree. So maybe you do let them continue to work on the old product, but the problem they're going to have, and it's an obvious one. Hopefully they would see it once this project's over. Their usefulness to the company may be coming to an end. So this might be this someone, you know, heading up on retirement, that might work. If they don't keep up with it, and you know, if you're a really big company, have a lot of products, maybe they can move to another product or division. But in a lot of cases, I would think just for survival and having the job, they would want to keep up with the direction the product was going. So, answering your question, I haven't really run into it a lot, but I would that's some of the questions I would ask them. Maybe they're ready for something new and it's time to move on. That's possible.
Another common scenario might be multiple offices. So a head office where the decisions are made, the architecture is decided, and then a remote office where you've got competent engineers, but because they're not there with you, it's harder to communicate what you want. What's your advice for including, let's say, remote offices with maybe a time difference of 7, 8, 9 hours in projects like this?
Yeah, I believe that I'm a big believer in bringing in everyone for the planning part, so that everybody has a say and has skin in the game for the planning. And what I'm talking about is, you know, if you do quarterly, you know, planning increments across the teams, where we lay out here for the next 3 months, here's the big objectives we have, here's what we're going to go get done, and everybody's lined up with it. And then from sprint to sprint, usually most companies are sprinting, right? So for the next 2 weeks, everybody's on the same page, and we get them all together for the planning, just at a minimum. And they'll probably have stand-ups and other times when they come together, but getting together for that planning piece and not leaving anybody out, so that everybody feels like they're a part of the plan, is really important. Most of my career, I've had, you know, good sized chunks of what we were doing offshored. Sometimes they were part of our company, sometimes they were not part of our company. And either way, wrapping your arms around them and having them be a part of the decision making, maybe not having the final say, but having their say, is really, really important. Because otherwise, if we can't get by, then we won't get buy-in if they don't feel like they're part of the plan. So I've tried to use, you know, hackathons, planning where everybody's, you know, if we do have planning, have everybody on video face-to-face as much as possible. Anything I can do to make that connection and bring us together as much as possible, really, really important, so that we're not, you know, nobody feels like, you know, if it ever felt like, oh, all the decisions are made out of that office, I would see that as a very negative pattern.
Given that what we're talking about could be many years, how do you keep the project on track, and how do you keep momentum and interest up?
That's a good question. So for one, for the momentum side, I think it's really important to build in a regular cadence of retrospective. So between the team that's doing the technical side and the project management side, and all the players in between, having some sort of cadence, say monthly or however often you want to set it up, biweekly. But talking about, you know, hey, we're doing this architecture bit while we're also keeping the existing product going. You know, what's working? What would improve it? How can we communicate better? And really, you know, kind of one of those key agile practices about learning. Build learning into the process so that everybody feels like we're getting better and better at doing the architecture, you know, in stride, you know, incrementally. And then the other concern I would have is how do you wrap it up and how do you keep momentum with success? So if the goal we're shooting for by doing this, you know, piecemeal is way out there on the horizon, it's 3 years, 4 years from now, that's a very long time in technology. Even 2 years is a long time for a project in technology. And we don't want it to feel like it's just, you know, this thing that's been hanging over us forever and we're not getting anywhere. So I would definitely try to make it milestone based to where we could carve out parts of the architecture where we know in 6 months, 9 months, wherever the target is, that we're going to have these key inflection points where we're delivering a major part of it, where we can demonstrate success and sell back to everybody how it's working, and then celebrate. I think the celebration bits in there are really, really important to keep momentum in a long-running project. You know, if you were doing Big Bang and you did this architecture, you know, redo in 9 months, 12 months, you could have the big party, the big celebration at the end. But even then, I would recommend putting in key objectives or key milestones throughout the process so that we can keep the momentum, keep everybody focused towards that next milestone, and then celebrate as a team, celebrate as a company every time we hit one.
Steve, any final notes before we wrap up for tonight?
No, I enjoyed it. It was a great conversation. I enjoy you having me, Brian.
What's the web address for your main site, Steve?
So we're agilecraft.com, AGILECRAFT, and we're The Agilecraft at Twitter.
Great. Steve Elliott, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Yeah, thank you.
The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Steps by Poddington Bear from the album Piano 2 Felt.